Good afternoon. This meeting of the House Energy Committee will now come to order. The time is 1:05 p.m. on Thursday, April 10th. Members present are Representative Rauscher, Representative Edgman, Co-Chair Holland, and myself, Co-Chair Mears. We have a quorum to conduct business. I'd like to remind members to please silence your cell phones. As a reminder, if anyone needs to pass a note to committee members, please get the attention of my wonderful committee aide, Ariel Svetlik, and she'll take care of it. Importantly, I'd like to thank Cheryl Cole, the record secretary, and Zach Loharn from the Juno LIO for tech and teleconferencing support. The only item of business before the committee is House Bill 153, Utilities Renewable Portfolio Standard, by my co-chair, Representative Kai Holland. The bill's sponsor has worked on a committee substitute incorporating feedback from previous hearings as well as stakeholders. As there was significant feedback, we've just received the committee substitute this afternoon. I'd like to note that the CS does not constitute the final draft of the bill, but reflects where we are now in the process. May I have a motion to adopt the CS?
Madam Chair, I move that the House Energy Committee adopt the committee substitute for House Bill 153, work order number 34-LS0501/G, as a working document.
I'll object for the purposes of discussion. Representative Holland, would you and your staff please introduce yourselves for the record and review the summary of changes?
Sure. Thank you, Chair Mears. This committee substitute represents a lot of work that's been done with a variety of stakeholders, including the utilities, to understand the concerns that they have with the renewable portfolio standards and the ability to structure this in a way that provides some benefits to the standard, as well as ameliorate some of the concerns that the original draft has. So I appreciate all of the work that has gone in and the availability of the stakeholders for these discussions and to provide us with input. At this point, I'd like to turn it over to my staff, Shana Kilcoyne, who can review the changes in this CS.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Shana Kilcoyne, staff for Representative Holland. I'll review the summary of changes for the CS today. First, on page 3, section 5, AS4205-900-1, extends the 40% target date from December 31st, 2030 to December 31st, 2032. On page 4, section 4205-905-B clarifies the process for calculating energy produced and used by a customer, which includes the multiplier of 2. Also on page 4, section 4205905D replaces energy efficiency investments with investments in energy efficiency technologies to conform with standard language. Also allows energy investments through programs that are established or approved by the state. On page 5, section 4205910, this section clarifies renewable portfolio credit. This was previously renewable energy credit. This is to signify it's within the load-serving entities that are subject to the Electric Reliability Organization or the Rail Belt Utilities. This language change is also in reflected in section 4205905C. On page 7, section 4205915G allows for a utility to use any noncompliance fee, whether they have reached the 40% threshold or not, to defray the costs of building future renewable electricity projects, integrating renewable electricity projects, including battery storage, into the load-serving entity's system, or purchasing renewable electricity. Funds shall be spent by 2035 for the first target threshold and 2040 for the second target threshold. Any unspent funds shall be remitted into the account to the Alaska Energy Authority for deposit in the Alaska Renewable Energy Grant Fund. This replaces fine with remittance to establish a difference from standard penalties levied by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. On page 7, section 4205925, we have two definitions changes. Sub 2 adds a community energy facility as defined in statute 4205735 under the definition of distributed energy systems. And on page 8, sub 7, this modifies the definition of renewable energy resource to mean a resource other than fossil fuel. Sorry, I said there are two. There are three. And then 7B2 removes the requirement that landfill gas be produced by municipal solid waste. Lastly, the CS removes all reference to power cost equalization communities. So it removes the ability to purchase renewable electricity credits from a PCE community. And it removes the exemption of revenue from the sale of recovered heat or revenue from the sale of renewable energy credits from the power cost equalization calculation. That is all.
Thank you for your work. There's a lot been done since last time we heard the bill. Any questions? Representative Rauscher.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Madam Chair. Through the Chair, I do have a couple. And I guess we were told that the utility companies have supported these changes. I wasn't there in my office, but I had heard that that's what was said. Am I wrong there?
Through the chair to Representative Rauscher, I think what I communicated was that we have been in contact with the utilities and consulting them and asking for their input. I don't know, Shana, if you have anything you want to add to that.
Through the chair, Shana Kilcoin for the record, Representative Rauscher. We've been working with the utilities, and some of these are in response to their suggestions, but we're still having these conversations. Some of them are still working through their boards, so it's not complete.
Okay, thank you. So just want to get a better understanding of after the 5 years, obviously I'm thinking that they're not going to make it, so I apologize. But if should they not make it, after 5 years, the money goes into the renewable grant fund, right? Is if they do not spend it yet on a renewable project within their own district, correct? So does that mean now that the fund can be used for anywhere in the state of Alaska? And if it can, how does that help reduce the costs of the ratepayers that paid into that when I thought that was the purpose?
Through the chair, I think your understanding is correct that if they were not able to use the funds on a qualified project, although I'll offer that the ability to use the funds has been expanded now with the input of the utilities to now also include batteries. So I think we've been providing more options for how that noncompliance fund balance can be used with the intent that there'll be plenty of places to use it, not only for infrastructure construction, other renewable projects, and even, as I understand it, purchasing renewable power. So there's a wide variety of ways this money can be used. There's no intention on this bill to move that money out of the utility. It is money intended to help the utility move towards the benefit of the renewables, but giving them some time and flexibility to aggregate this money if they don't meet it in time. But at the end of the day, if this were to completely lapse after 5 years, yes, it does go into the REF fund. It does keep it in the state. It keeps it within the purview of renewable energy projects, and it does keep the state moving ahead in a direction of trying to reduce its energy costs overall. But, you know, I do concede that at the end of the day, if we got all the way down to that eventual waterfall, it would be going to the benefit of the state's reduced cost of energy and not directly to that one utility. But our understanding, our intent, and our effort is to help construct this in a way that this helps that utility use that money in that utility to reduce and manage the cost of their energy in their utility.
Philip, yeah, I appreciate that. And I was just wondering, maybe in the future we could probably figure out a way to point it toward the offending district, utility district. So where it would help them out, because that's where that fund I thought was supposed to help them out. Anyway, so I just want to move on. So investments in energy efficiency technologies instead of energy efficiency investments. So I'm trying to understand. So I've been to, maybe you have too, been to Idaho, and looked at their technologies that they're investing their time and money in. And is investing that money in something like that count here? Because I'm not sure I understand the definition of what we're talking about when it's just any kind of a technology. I'm trying to, now the money goes out of state. Is it allowable under this, or is that something that I'm not understanding quite correctly?
Sure. Through the chair, I'm going to ask staff to help me clarify the technical clarification that's being made with this change in terms. I don't think the intent is the money is going out any place, but I think it is expanding and clarifying how the money could be used by the utility for the utility to enhance their renewable conformance to the renewable targets in there. But Jane, do you have a clarification on this language change and the intent behind it?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, I can confirm that, but I don't think that they're able to use investments outside of state. The intent is for them to be able to use it for their system, so only in that utility. So if that needs clarification, we're happy to work on that.
Okay. Thank you. So I guess I just want to understand the cost to the consumer. Should the threshold amount be met in both instances? You have a 40% and you have a 55, depending on the year that we're talking about. And you've added 2 years to the 40%, which gives them a little more breather room there. But I'm trying to understand the if the targets are met, but the ratepayers are paying more to achieve the 40% target. Is that a policy success in this, or is this a problem that we have to look at?
Through the chair, you know, the challenge, I think, has two facets to it. One is that we know by looking at what's going on in the rest of the country that over 90% of the projects being done now are renewable projects. This is simply the way utilities across the country are saving their ratepayers money. And so our intent is that these projects, while I concede that the first couple projects like a Fire Island may look quite expensive, the reality is Fire Island will be cheaper once we start comparing it to the cost of imported natural gas. So even the project that we sometimes look at as an example of, you know, does this really work, will work even in the small scale that it's had here in Alaska. The so one is there is an intent, there is global data that suggests that this is the cheaper way to go. So our intent is to help move this along, including using any noncompliance to help the utilities move even further along. The other aspect of this that I think is important is the volatility of the pricing, that there is concern that as we move into a new regime of imported gas or gas that might be tied to global market prices, that the volatility that we will see in our energy prices will dramatically increase. And we know that renewable energy, once we pay the upfront cost, becomes very stable because the cost of fuel for wind, for solar, is essentially zero. So even in the worst case, if we assume that the price of energy was the same, maybe even I'll concede it could be slightly higher, the reality is there'll be a tremendous benefit to consumers with stable pricing and predictable pricing for purposes of making investments in our community and investments of businesses that don't have the uncertainty about our small markets being subject to larger volatility. So in the end, the intent here is to help move towards controlling the cost of energy, perhaps bringing it down, and the real benefit is the stability of the pricing.
I appreciate it. And then through the chair, follow-up. So remittance and fines. We've changed the word fine to remittance, and I'm just trying to understand the technical aspect of desiring to go that route.
Through the chair, Shana Kilcoyne, for the record, Representative Rauscher, This is just to clarify that fines that come from the RCA to utilities typically go into the RCA, and this is different in that they stay with the utility in order to help the utility use those fees, or may go to the Alaska Energy Authority. So it's just to help clarify that it's not a typical RCA fine that they have gotten, that they are subject to.
And a quick follow-up. Is there a way to enforce, I guess, a mechanism of enforcement to understand whether or not the utility companies have actually misused the fine money, the remittance money, on something that's not qualified? So who does the check and balance on that so we could get an assurance that the money that the ratepayer will end up giving to this will actually be spent correctly?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, it's a good question, and typically I believe that it would just go through the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. And so I don't know if that is needed to be clarified in policy or if that is more about how it gets implemented in regulation. But the utility, I presume, would be reporting to the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, who would determine whether those are appropriate.
And then one last follow-up at this moment. When it goes through past the 5 years, and now we're headed to the renewable fund, is that UGF designated fund, undesignated fund? How does that work? I just want to understand the mechanism of where the money actually. It seems like it goes into the budget, but is it designated, underdesignated, before it gets into the fund? How does that work?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, typically the legislature is allocating funding to the Renewable Energy Fund, and that's why you see projects every year. My understanding is that if we do it this way, it would go directly to the fund. And I spoke to legal about this, whether it still has to be allocated or not, and I'm blanking on exactly the clarification, so I'm happy to follow up on that.
Okay, thank you.
That's a good one. Yeah. Still has to be appropriated. Yeah. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
And just through the chair, just to clarify on the fund, it's on page 7, line 9, that account that's going to hold that money is an account approved by the commission. So they have purview and control over that account, and I would assume then with the explanation I got from Shana that they're going to be able to watch that account.
Thank you.
And I had a question.
Since we've got a pause in the discussion, I'd like to note for the record that Representative Costello joined us about 108 and Representative Kopp at 111. So welcome to the discussion. Next, Co-Chair Holland.
You had a question from Costello.
Representative Costello.
Thank you. My question has to do with removal of the portion of the bill that says you can purchase renewable electricity credits from utilities that serve customers who receive PCE. And I was curious, how many utilities in Alaska have customers who receive PCE?
Through the chair, Representative Costello, if you could clarify, how many utilities have customers that receive PCE?
Correct.
I don't know that off the top of my head, Representative, but I believe it's over 100.
Actually, I can answer that. The utilities are in the mid-80s, and the communities are well over 100.
Representative,
a follow-up.
So the committee substitute removes the ability for a utility. It does not allow utilities who serve PCE customers to sell their credits. And I'm curious what, if any, problems will be created by having a group of utilities that can sell their credits versus a group of utilities that you cannot purchase credits from. And then was there any consideration given to perhaps allowing utilities that serve PCE customers to purchase credits from each other?
Through the chair, Representative Costello, thank you for the question. What this is working to do is clarify that it's creating a closed market for rail belt utilities, and so it has, and that was just to help clarify that a renewable energy credit, as if we are familiar with them, it separates this from a standard renewable energy credit, and it does not disallow a community that receives power cost equalization from selling credits either to rail belt communities or amongst themselves. If a rail belt utility were to purchase a credit from a power cost equalization, this bill says nothing about it. They can, but it would not help them meet the standard. And so what this does is just allow a renewable, and we've changed the word to renewable portfolio credit, just to establish that this is different than an energy credit, and a portfolio credit can only be traded within the rail belt. It's really only for the purposes of the standard. And I'm not sure if I fully answered your question, Representative.
So I'd actually like to remove my objection to adopting the C at this point, because we do have some conflict with some members leaving, unless there's a further objection to adopting the CS at this point to continue discussion.
Madam Chair, I won't object to adopting the CS, but that's not a reflection of where I'm at on the bill overall.
But pardon me, I didn't hear.
Just to talk about adopting the committee substitute for purposes of discussion.
Yeah, we do have some conflicts. Brief at ease. So then. Back on the record. So with no objection standing, we have adopted this CS, but we are still enjoying some conversation on the bill. I'd like to keep this brief at the moment, since we do have a number of public testifiers. This is not our last hearing on the bill, and if we do have time after public testimony, we can continue as well. Are there any questions that the committee would like to get into at this point before public testimony?
If I could, Chair?
Yes.
I just want to follow up briefly on the last question from Representative Costello. The way I would view this is that this bill now removes itself from making any changes to the PCE world. It had introduced the idea that PCE communities could be a source of renewable energy credits that a rail belt utility might have purchased, but clarified for the benefit of the PCE utilities that if they happen to sell those credits, that it would not affect their qualification for any PCE funds. So this was a benefit to the PCE communities. We were basically giving them a new source of potential revenue and protecting them that they would not be harmed from this new revenue. But there was concern that if we began talking about PCE in any way, even if it was meant to be of benefit, that it was distracting, and the reality was we really wasn't expecting that there was going to be much PCE renewable energy activity. So we've basically just taken the section out. It's silent. So nothing in this bill has any effect in the PCE world. Whatever they could do before, they can keep on doing. This bill is basically stepping away from what was of benefit to the PCE world and just moving to just focusing in on the ability within the rail belt for these renewable energy credits to be exchanged. But it's not taking away anything from the PCE world.
And I think there's opportunities to have a more robust discussion very specifically on communities that receive PCE that's more complete rather than just dealing it in pieces of another piece of legislation. Mm-hmm. Representative Kopp.
Thank you. It's my understanding that this version of the bill kind of does away with the problem of penalizing ratepayers for not meeting renewable targets by establishing a fund that the purpose of the fund is to put the money back into the utilities to help them meet it rather than have a failure to meet a standard be passed through to the ratepayers. Do I understand that correctly?
Yeah, through the chair, that's right. But, you know, to be clear, if that money that went into the fund for the benefit of the utility, if it 5 years down the road, they still hadn't found a way to use it, which we've expanded the way they could use it. So there's really, you know, there's no intent for them not to be able to use it. But just to be clear, if they got 5 years down the road and still had some balance that didn't get used, it would roll out and into the renewable energy fund rather than before it rolled into potentially the UGF. And the intent was we wanted to put it into preserving the ability of that money to be used for the benefit of renewable energy projects. In this case, it would roll out to a statewide fund balance. But again, the intent here is that there wouldn't be a balance. We're not trying to create a source of money. We're trying to just simply hold it so that the utility can use it for the benefit of their ratepayers and for the benefit of the projects that would advance renewable energy meeting those targets.
Okay. Thank you. Just a follow-up. It would be good, maybe it's invited testimony on this, just to understand what the risk to the state is if these net zero and decarbonization design efforts are no longer funded or incentivized by the federal government, but we're setting a standard saying we want you to go this way, but all the support for it from the federal government is being clawed back. How could that affect ultimately the gas line, which we all want to see happen, and you know, maybe another large energy project that could be considered non-renewable. Just want to see what, you know, in light of there's a time and place for everything under the sun, timing for everything. Are we now in a time when all the incentives to support utilities going in this direction are simply not available now where maybe they were?
I'd just like to say I'd love to see our future where we've got a plethora of energy electricity generation sources, and we've got those opportunities for us. So
yeah,
that's the version of the world I'd love to see.
Yeah, if I can follow up just yes, briefly, two thoughts. One is part of that uncertainty is why we're moving the date out to 2032. Because we are in a point of time at the moment where there is some uncertainty, and we recognize that some of the project momentum is on pause, and this provides some clarity that we need a little time to see how these things unfreeze themselves. The other thing I'd note, though, is that globally, even in places where there are not renewable energy or other incentives for climate-based type of approach, they're still putting these renewable projects forward. Yes, you're right that in the U.S. we have a unique environment of trying to accelerate those changes, but the simple reality is that the batteries, the wind turbines, the solar panels have dropped so dramatically in price that it just simply is a more affordable energy source now. So I think we'll see that this will continue even if some of the federal price and credits go away, because we can see in other markets that it has.
Thanks.
So I'd like to know, we'll get to Representative Rauscher, but we might want to keep our conversation brief because we do have a couple of dozen people online for public testimony. Representative Rauscher.
I just thank you, through the chair. I just want to make sure that we're going to get a legal understanding of how this money gets appropriated to the renewable fund, whether it's a statutory separate fund, whether it's general, and whether it could be misappropriated if it's in the general, and what actually sticks it to the renewable fund, if I could. That's all I'm saying.
I agree. That'd be good to get.
All right. Any further discussion before we go to public testimony? Thank you very much for the discussion. So we are going to get to public testimony. I'd like to remind the public that written testimony is very welcome on the bill.
and could be submitted via email to house.energy@akleg.gov. The committee has posted all received written testimony so far on basis under the committee meeting, where it can be viewed by members of the public as well as committee members. Given the number of testifiers I see queued up and the time available to us today, I'll be limiting testifiers to 2 minutes, so please feel free to submit that written testimony. I do intend to hold open public testimony to our next meeting when folks have had more time to review the committee substitute. If you testify today, you will be allowed to testify again, but if you do have follow-up testimony, please keep it extra brief. And written testimony is always welcome, whether or not you've testified with verbal testimony. Is there anyone in the room today to testify? Oh, let me open up public testimony first. Public testimony is now open. All right, seeing no one in the room at the moment, we'll start with online testimony. We'll start with the Matsu LIO with Carol Campbell. Please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify. Just a couple of points here. Why is this happening in Alaska when we know that from the UAF Geological Institute that the coal alone in Alaska at a minimum estimate is 15,000 years worth of power to power the entire state? So we have available resources here, and I noticed several people mentioning, including in the paperwork write-ups, comparing the cost of these projects to imported gas. Well, we don't have to import gas. We have other options that are local that we could do. So looking at the concept from the big picture, government is here to not force things onto us. It's here to secure our rights, as stated in the Declaration of Independence. Why don't we look at a way to incentivize and get power into the grid, if you want extra power into the grid, on a micro scale? So the large solar farms and wind turbines are generally considered to be an ecological disaster where they're used. They're not completely recyclable. They take extra energy, that is diesel power, to fly the helicopters, to build them, to maintain them, et cetera, et cetera. We're looking at some estimates of 500,000 birds. This is an average of 4 different studies on bird kill at windmill farms in the United States alone. Is 500,000 birds for that estimate. I have all these resources available, Representative Rauscher, or anybody would like to see them. But this is an ecological disaster. Do people come to Alaska on their once-in-a-lifetime vacation to see massive wind farms? Do they come to Alaska on their once-in-a-lifetime vacation to see giant solar farms? No, they don't. We have hydro available. We have coal available.
Please wrap up your testimony.
You bet. We have nuclear available. There are other options, so let's incentivize micro individual homes to have wind and solar, not massive scale wind and solar. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Next up, we have Wayne Woods. Please state your name for the record, if you have any affiliations, and begin your testimony.
Thank you, staff and members of the Energy Committee. My name is Wayne Woods. I live in the Matsu Borough, and I am a lifelong Alaskan. I tell people that I was conceived in the territory, but born in the state, to give you an idea of my age. I'm a professional hunter by trade, and along with my wife and family, I have operated a tourism-related business in Alaska since 1986 until this present day. I just want to address you as to my perception of HB 153 regarding renewable portfolio standards legislation. In my personal opinion, instead of lower costs, stable electric energy for the people of Alaska, this does exactly the opposite. And it's by mandating the use of technology that's proven to be neither cost-effective or reliable. This these standards can only be achieved through the extortion of government mandates to producers, with increased rates and costs to the consumer, and subsidies with public funding or grants, and trying to sell that to us as investment. This is a great deal if you are in the green energy business, but this is an idea that has passed its sell-by date. This is evidenced by a new administration in America, leading with overwhelming popular support and giving clear resource development directives to lower costs to the consumer and increase our living standards. Alaska is a resource superpower, and the people of Alaska should not be further hindered in our quality of life by short-sighted local mandates that benefit the few at the cost of clear violation of the public trust.
Please wrap up your testimony. Thank you. Thank you. Perfect timing. Thank you very much. Next, we'll go to Gordon Bissell.
Good day. My name is Gordon Bissell, a longtime Valley resident. And I want to thank everybody for the opportunity to give some testimony here. Unfortunately, mine is not quite as clear and cut as Mr. Woods's or Mr. Campbell's. I will attest to the fact that I've utilized on a personal level both solar and wind power, and currently utilize a diesel for a power generation system. I've encountered numerous problems with the wind and solar electrical generation with solar panels and wind generators, and I anticipate anything coming across the state's doorstep on that regard is going to encounter something similar. All these components will have to be dealt with on a much larger scale, both for maintenance and disposal when they are damaged. We currently look at, you know, regions of the country that sustain extreme high winds, major fluctuating temperatures. Maintaining these windmills will be a major endeavor trying to just keep them operational. Then, in light of the fact that we experience numerous earthquakes and volcano eruptions, whether predicted or actual showing up, could wreak havoc on a lot of these proposed solar panels. There's a lot of components that would have to be put into place here. As far as the not having any natural gas available sort of thing and trying to import it, I believe that is a 100% fallacy. There is ample sources of available natural gas on the North Slope that will, in the future, be exportable, in my opinion. Having seen it and worked in that region, it's going to come. And I think the state and the federal government would be remiss not to address that.
Please wrap up your testimony. Perfect timing again. thank you so much. Next, we'll go to Doug Glenn.
Hi there, Doug Glenn, Palmer resident, and I'm a Matsu Borough Commissioner, and I'm not speaking for the Matsu Borough or the Planning Commission right now. But thank you for the opportunity to speak. I'm in opposition to HB 153, and I have a particular dislike for industrial windmills, and I see no place for them in Alaska. They're high maintenance. They are incredible for wiping out migratory waterfowl, and unfortunately, that's where their foot is, in flyways everywhere. So, if we wanted to go to renewable, we would have built the Watana Dam when we should have built it, and that got shot down, and so we've lost that opportunity. And I wouldn't be opposed to go back and rebuild the Watana Dam, and I'd rather have that than industrial windmills or solar panel farms. And, I just pulled up a website, and in Germany, they're going away from their current coal burning and going to this renewable energy, and they're estimating a 67% increase in electricity costs. So this isn't a real good thing for Alaska. And I appreciate the opportunity, and I hope you'll rethink all of this. Thank you.
Thank you for taking your testimony. Next, we'll go to Homer. Paul Seaton.
This is Paul Seaton in Homer, representing myself. Appreciate the opportunity to testify on this today, and I support going to a renewable portfolio standard. I have a question in the CS under Section 4205-915G. I notice it says that funds shall be spent by that five-year deadline, and I think it should be clarified that the funds need to be committed to a project that is ongoing, because I think the term of spent could be misinterpreted so that those funds could then go to the Alaska Energy Authority. So, but I appreciate this. I did want to let you know that this is anything we can do to help push this along is great. The Homer Electric Association just this week voted to take over and complete the Puppy Dog Lake 45 megawatt solar farm in Nikiski, and their establishment there is that the electricity generated there will be cheaper than our current electricity produced with gas, even at our gas price right now, not even projected for the increase in gas prices. So appreciate you working on this, and thanks very much. Well, that's it.
Thank you, former Representative Seaton. I appreciate your legislative input and continued service. Next, we'll go to David Braley.
My name is David Braley, and I'm the owner and operator of the Juniper Creek Hydroelectric System in Eagle River. This system meets the annual power requirements for about 200 homes in the upper Eagle River Valley. I'd like to respond to a comment made by Representative Mia Costello to this committee on April 1st. This comment said that instead of state mandates that include fines, we should address the situation by having conversations between ratepayers and utilities at the local level. My response is that conversations between ratepayers and utilities have been going on for a long time. In 2018, NEA ratepayers made a statement in the form of a statistically representative member survey indicating that 70% of members thought that NEA should get more power from renewables. This was way before Hillcorp announced that they weren't going to renew NEA's gas contract, so we began looking at a 50% increase in cost. I could find some quotes to characterize NEA's response in this conversation, but actions speak louder than words. The fact is that since that survey result was published, NEA has not developed any new renewable generation of their own, but relies on Bradley Lake, Kootenai, and independent power producers to generate renewable energy. The reason that we only have 1 or 2% of real electric market penetration by independent power producers is because of onerous contract terms in real power purchase agreements. My power purchase agreement is a standard MEA contract that reads the same as all of MEA's power purchase agreements, and they're all available on the RCA website. First, all these contracts have a clause that says MEA shall receive 50% of the renewable energy credits attributed to any project. Now, NEA doesn't produce any renewable energy, but by refusing to sign power purchase agreements that don't give them half of our RECs, they're getting the same benefit from the RPS that we are. You might say, well, they want 50% of the RECs to pay for interconnection and integration costs. Actually, NEA's standard contract requires the independent power producer to pay for 100% of interconnection and integration costs. Taken together, these two clauses sound pretty unfair, but let me add to the picture. In lower 48 energy markets, independent power producers get paid not just for energy, which is mainly the cost of fuel, but they also get paid for capacity, which is the promise of delivering a specific amount of power at a specific time. Capacity is what makes firm power more valuable than non-firm power because it provides reliability. You're paying to guarantee that the power will be there when you need it, regardless of whether the sun is shining or the wind is blowing. Here in the Alaska Rail Belt, FERC had no jurisdiction over the implementation over the Public Utilities Regulatory Policy Act of 1978, And the result is that no independent power producer has ever been paid for capacity. In other words, firm renewable power has no value in the Alaska Rail Belt, which is encouraging us to develop unreliable power sources that will always require fossil fuel backup. Similarly, no independent power producer has ever been paid for reactive power, which is the energy that is required to maintain acceptable voltage levels. Same thing with avoided transmission costs. I have to hurry up here.
Please wrap up, and then you've got a lot of input. Please add your written testimony.
I actually haven't submitted any, but to sum it up, the system is really slanted. The playing field is completely slanted towards utilities, and that's why we only have 1 or 2% market penetration by renewables. And if Representative Costello is voting for conversations between utilities and ratepayers instead of state mandates, we're going to have the same situation for the next 40 years. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have Ken Hakaba.
Good morning. I'm Ken Hakaba. I represent myself, a citizen, not an NGO, nor any other incorrectly labeled quote-unquote stakeholder or special interest that may benefit, profit, or be empowered by this bill. I oppose Alaska HB 153, which mandates a renewable energy portfolio standard for electric utilities on a status-mandated schedule as supplied without known costs or risks, as seen in other countries where this is contrived policy has caused so much damage to their economy, industries, and ratepayers to no known or stated results. This bill sounds green, but is it a costly gamble for Alaska? Our state's unique geography and climate make reliance on solar, wind, and other renewables unreliable and very expensive. Utilities will face steep compliance costs passed on to ratepayers, that is us, by raising our electric bills when many Alaskans already struggle to heat their homes. The bill ignores our dependence on stable energy sources like natural gas and coal and risks blackouts in a region where power isn't optional. It's survival. Plus, the aggressive timeline dismisses practical utilities and practical realities, I mean. The rural grids can't pivot this fast without massive unfunded upgrades. Now, let's look at how this came about. Let's look at the representative type, Mr. Holla, here, and this is related to the bill, please. The bill sponsor for District 9, elected in 2024 as an independent. Mr. Holland touts his engineering and startup credentials for promising sustainable prosperity. But his ties to Alaska Version 3, an NGO he co-founded, raises red flags. This group pushes economic reinvention through venture funds, often favoring trendy projects like renewables over proven industries. His roles at Alyeska Venture Management and Alaska Accelerator Fund deepened this concern, suggesting that HB 153 might benefit a clique of well-connected green tech entrepreneurs rather than everyday Alaskans. Mr. Holland pitches this is a progress, but it feels like a pet project leveraging his NGO network to force a one-size-fits-all policy on a state that thrives on flexibility. As we heard at 118, Mr. Holland states gross misinterpretation of actual costs and effects around the globe, as seen in myriad of current news stories from Europe and Germany in particular, as previously mentioned. We have seen renewable implementation in other countries, and it has led to unreliability and escalated to energy costs and shortages. At this point, I'm calling for removal of Mr. Holland from the committee or being recused from the committee and especially voting on this bill entirely. Lastly, about this notion of stakeholders again, I don't see this term in the Constitution of the United States of America nor in the Constitution of the State of Alaska, and request the cessation of it and its involvement in processes in our business of the legislature and the representative republic. Thank you for the opportunity. Do you have any?
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have Michael Kraft.
Yes. Thank you so much. My name is Michael Kraft. I live in Fairbanks, Alaska. I've been here 45 years. I'm the owner and operator of the Delta Wind Farm. I put the first wind farm on the rail belt grid. The first commercial scale turbine went up in Delta Junction in 2008. And I want to echo the feelings of that last independent power producer with respect to trying to negotiate projects with the utilities. It's been a nightmare. I'll tell you what the public's hearing here in Fairbanks. Generation capacity shortages, fuel shortages. We're dealing with bad air quality. We're dealing with ash piles all over our community. And we're paying some of the highest cost for those privileges. If I like to look back at 2010 with Sarah Palin with our 50% renewables by 2025, that was a policy that was set by the state. It was paid for by the state. It was voted on by the legislature, and it had no teeth to it. And so it didn't do anything. If we had done it, we would have 50% of our power coming from renewables right now. And I can tell you, I've never found once a dead bird in my wind farm. And those turbines have operated all the way down to minus 50 consistently for over a decade with an annual output of about 4 million kilowatt hours of power from one year to the next. Very stable. As far as energy security goes, you know, I'm watching you guys run out of gas down there, and I'm watching us having oil shortages up here. That would never happen with a renewable energy project. Those fuel sources are available 24/7, 365, although intermittent, granted. At this point, we are trying to bring forward a project of 35 megawatts. And the comments I get from people is when they drive down the Alaska Highway coming towards Delta Junction from Canada, they look forward to seeing those turbines out there because it gives them kind of warm and fuzzy. They know that the power that they're using is clean and it's reliable. To that, I'd like to say thank you, and I hope you support this bill. And I think that we're long overdue, and anything that you could think of on the form of hydrocarbon, whether it's a pipeline or a new coal plant, is a decade or more out, and wind and solar is within 24 months. So whether you like renewables or not, it's really the only option on the table at this point to curtail the energy shortages and the tariffs being developed right now for cutting customers off in the event and when it happens of fuel shortages. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have Chris Rose.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, mayors, and Howell, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chris Rose. I'm the executive director of Renewable Energy Alaska Project, or REAP. I'm also a member of the board of directors of the Railroad Reliability Council, but today I'm representing only REAP. REAP supports House Bill 153 and respectfully urges the committee to move the bill. REAP does not seek any other piece of legislation currently being proposed that would have the same type of immediate positive impact on the Railbelt energy crisis. In South Central, where almost a half million people live, 85% of the electricity is generated from natural gas, a local resource that's risen in price almost 800% in the last 35 years. And yet, in that same period, our dependence on natural gas has barely budged. The four member-owned railway cooperatives Alaskans rely on have failed to diversify the generation portfolio, in part because there are so many multiple decision-makers on a relatively tiny grid. Utilities have had plenty of warning and opportunity, but nonetheless, here we are about to import LNG. In 2009, the Department of Natural Resources Division of Oil and Gas projected the supply of cook inlet gas could come up short beginning in 2027, and DNR followed that study up several times with the same result, but there still was no significant action taken by the utilities to diversify. In 2010, as was mentioned, Governor Palin signed legislation to setting a goal of 50% renewable by 2025. But because the legislation had no teeth and set only aspirational goals, nothing happened. I bring this history up not to lay blame, but to point out that voluntary efforts to diversify the electricity grid for the beating heart of the state's economy have simply not resulted in action, and we do need action now. Utilities, as has been mentioned, are actively negotiating to bring liquefied natural gas up to cook inlet, probably from Canada. Rather than becoming energy independent through the development of a local, stably priced renewable resources, we're on the verge of becoming even more dependent on gas from another country. Not only will that gas be between 50 and 100% more expensive than our current cook inlet gas contract, LNG is also going to be indexed to world commodity market, meaning the price will be subject to intense volatility. And this is going to impact heating customers even more than electricity customers, and not make this state a very attractive place to live, work, or invest. We believe an RPS will catalyze much-needed cooperation among the railroad utilities. Together, they will be able to make better decisions and build bigger projects. And an RPS will push the utilities toward operating the grid together. A recent study commissioned by the utilities themselves found that having multiple operators of the system is costing railroad consumers at least $47 million a year. The RPS would also send a policy signal Alaska is open for business and will attract more renewable energy developers to the state to compete with each other to build projects and sell power to the utilities. Because today in the railroad there is no market and there is no competition, and electricity prices are 50% higher than the rest of the country. We don't believe we can afford to wait any longer for the utilities to act on their own. The RPS being proposed is not unique. It's very doable. We have confidence the utilities will easily be able to meet the standard if they work together. An RPS requires the development of stably priced local renewable resources that would bring investment certainty to their rail belt. And without that legislation, we are headed toward a truly uncertain future. That's my testimony. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Next up, we have Aiden McKinnon.
How's it going? My name is Aiden McKinnon. With just a little bit of research and the same public resources available to all Alaskans, this is the conclusion I've came to. I graduated high school, I'm a lifelong Alaskan, and I strongly oppose House Bill 153. This bill forces unreliable energy onto our grid, raises costs, and threatens power stability for Alaskans. It's driven by outside interests, not only people who actually live here. We need affordable, reliable energy, not mandates that punish ratepayers. Please vote no on House Bill 153. Thank you.
Thank you. Cassie Andrews, please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cassie Andrews, and I'm representing myself out of Anchorage. I urge you to oppose House Bill 153. This bill forces our co-ops into unreliable sources like wind and solar, and the state should not be mandating that liability. This bill hands our co-op boards an easy excuse. When the rates rise or blackouts happen, they'll just say it's the state's mandate. Ratepayers are not asking for higher bills or less reliability, but that's exactly what this policy delivers. Our co-ops risk being reduced to little more than a billing office. Look at Texas. They implemented a renewable portfolio standard and centralized grid oversight through ERCOT. After Winter Storm Uri, over 70 people died, billions were lost, and ERCOT faced class action lawsuits. Even though they claimed immunity, the Texas Supreme Court ruled they could still be sued. Some cases may have been dismissed, but many still remain. The fallout continues. We should be learning from disasters of centralized planning and mandates, not rushing to repeat them. Just 2 days ago, President Trump issued executive orders defending energy freedom and warning against state mandates like House Bill 153. The order says, state-imposed mandates and restrictions that limit the type, quantity, or method of energy production or delivery within a state or region pose a threat to national energy security, public welfare, and the resilience of the electrical grid. That is exactly what is happening here. House Bill 150 creates energy choices, risks reliability, and puts ratepayers on the hook for an unreliable experiment. If wind and solar were truly viable, the co-op boards could adopt them today, but they know the risks, so they want the state to give them cover. Do not give them that cover. Please do not move House Bill 153 forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we go to North Pole. Santa Claus, please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and committee members. This is Santa Claus in North Pole testifying as an Alaska voter in support of House Bill 153. I agree with researcher Aurora Roth that a renewable portfolio standard is a policy that provides investment certainty that can attract more experienced independent power producers to compete with each other in the rail belt benefiting consumers. The RPS would provide rail belt utilities with regulatory certainty about their investments in renewable energy. The RPS would catalyze more necessary cooperation between the rail belt utilities to meet the standard. The RPS provides necessary sideboards to current LNG negotiations and would give the electric utilities a modicum of negotiating leverage they currently do not have. The rail belt has enormous renewable energy resource potential. The cost of renewable energy technologies like wind, solar, and battery storage have all been declining rapidly. There are several renewable energy projects that already proposed that could raise the percentage of renewable electricity in the rail belt to 40%, the amount required by 2032 on the standard. The rail belt's renewable energy resources can lead to the development of local industries, creating local jobs. More renewable electricity keeps Alaskans' precious energy dollars in the state rather than those dollars being exported to out-of-state or out-of-country providers. I support House Bill 153 and encourage you to do the same. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Santa. Next up, we've got Julia Inga.
Hi, I'm Julia Inga from Palmer. I'm speaking for myself and I strongly oppose HB 153. We need power that works, plain and simple. I'm all in for President Trump's executive orders that push against state overreach and those rules that threaten to choke out reliable, affordable energy. I'm here, up here, we don't have time for fairy tales about wind and solar forced down our throats by clueless mandates. I'm not against smart solutions, but I'm done with unproven gambles. That's why I'm here today. I'm sick of the trendy nonsense that costs us a fortune, kills the environment, to pretend to save and leaves us in the dirt. What happens on cloudy days? We deserve policies that keep the lights on and the heat running without breaking our backs, not flashy projects that deliver squat. I'm ready to see us focus on Alaska, what Alaska does best, harnessing our abundant natural resources, oil, gas, and coal. You're on the hook to put us first, not some green agenda. I strongly oppose HB 153. I expect you to ditch the hype and fight for what works. Alaska's counting on it. Prove that you are Alaskan first, not Alaskan last. Thank you. I'm done.
Thank you very much. Next up, we've got Melissa Swope.
Good afternoon. I'm Melissa Swope from Homer. I'm laughing.
Hold up a moment. Ms. Swope, could you get maybe a little closer to your mic? It's very muffled here in the room. Say again.
I'm opposed to HB 153. Mandating wind and solar through a renewable portfolio standard is very wrong for our state. There's really nothing warm and fuzzy about a bunch of wind turbines and solar panels. Those are very site-specific energy sources, and I just don't think that is, you know, statewide a good fit. Alaska's winters and erratic winds make solar and wind power unreliable. And we should be looking into things like small nuclear reactor, natural gas, and exploiting our coal sources. We can't risk blackouts in our harsh climate. The costs hit hard. Remote construction and battery storage will spike rates, while HB 153's convoluted credit system taxes Alaskans by forcing utilities to buy credit, costs we pay to benefit out-of-state firms. Ecologically, it's a proven disaster. Wind turbines kill birds and threaten our migratory species and fragile ecosystems. Solar farms disrupt habitats with sprawling land use, and small nuclear reactors and natural gas and coal offer us reliable power with less environmental harm. This bill pushes unproven technologies and bureaucratic nonsense over better options, stripping Alaskans of choice for outsider agendas. Please vote no on HB 153. We need affordable, reliable energy, not costly experiments, hidden taxes, and wildlife losses. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Could you please repeat your name for the record since you came in a little muffled?
Liz.
And where you live?
I'm sorry. I have a cold. It's Melissa Swope.
Thank you very much. And I have here that you're from Homer.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you very much. It was just a little hard to hear in the beginning of the call. Next up, we have Marcus Moore.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was so muted. Good afternoon, members of the House Energy Committee. My name is Marcus Moore, born and raised Alaskan. I represent myself. I'm here to strongly oppose House Bill 153. This bill forces unreliable wind and solar energy under our grid, raising costs and risking energy stability for Alaskans. This bill demands 40% of our energy comes from renewables by 2032 and 55% still by 2035, despite the roadblock currently sitting at 15% of renewable energies. Yet, the same group behind this bill also pushed the campaign trying to remove the Aklutna Dam, which was around 14% of that total 15% renewable energy source for the rail belt. So if hydro is considered a renewable, why aren't we focusing more on that? It's already 14 out of the 15% of our renewable energy currently. This bill also forces co-ops to adopt intermittent power sources like wind, which during the 2024 cold snap on Fire Island, it fell to zero energy output in January when we needed it the most. Also, the financial burden to ratepayers is undeniable. The co-opted IPPs missing these targets face fines of $45 per megawatt hour shortfall, which Representative Hollard staffer Shannon Kilcoyne already admitted that it will ultimately hit ratepayers. Well, that's everyone that pays an electric bill. For hospitals using 10,000 megawatt hours annually, a 20% shortfall means hundreds of thousand dollar fines every year. For residential homes, that's hundreds of dollars more. On top of the already rising costs, this bill will continue to raise costs on as more renewables come online. And their intermittency issues, we're already seeing rolling blackouts across Anchorage, Eagle River, and Mattoon. This energy policy isn't driven by Alaskans, but by outside climate activists and NGOs, like the Alaska Venture Fund, backed by millions of dollars from the Bezos Earth Fund. It seems like you're prioritizing their agenda over our needs, repackaging this renewable portfolio standard again and again and again, the third time, as a solution to the gas crisis is just insanity, trying to do the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. We need reliable, stable, affordable energy, not mandates that push ratepayers and force utilities to destabilize our grid. I urge you to reject House Bill 153, focus on sensible energy solutions like hydro and clean coal, and put Alaskans first. Thanks for listening to my testimony.
Thank you. Next up is Doug Johnson. Go ahead, Doug.
Good morning. Hello. Yeah, this is Doug Johnson. I'm calling from Anchorage, Alaska. First of all, I want to thank Committee Chair Aaron Holland for this hearing today and all the committee members for their hard work on this bill. I'm speaking today in support of House Bill 153, and the reason I am speaking in support of it is because I believe it really is part of Alaska's energy future. And to me, it's not a question of if we're moving to renewables, it's when and how. You know, Mother Nature is not making hydrocarbons like she used to, and it's time to face that and move forward. I grew up in the oil and gas industry and really see the potential there. We still have a lot of gas, we still have a lot of oil, and they should be developed. But as we move forward over time, it's going to be more and more important for new technologies to find their way forward. Currently, I act as the development director for Ocean Renewable Power in Alaska, and we're developing the Cook Inlet Tidal Energy Project. For us, right now, out there in the marketplace looking for investment, a bill like House Bill 153 is imperative. We need that clarity of clear line of sight to the future for investors to be willing to step up and invest in projects like ours. We just finished successfully phase one of a five-phase project. This has been something that's been worked on for a number of years. I started working on this project in 2006, and with diligence we continue. And again, it's not a question of if we'll harness the tides of Cook Inlet, it's when and how. And what this RPS legislation sets up, I believe, is a clear playing field for investment in the future of Alaska's energy future. And I really encourage the committee to continue the deliberation and the great work you're doing. This is not easy work. But I do suggest that this House bill is the framework for a bright energy future for Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mark Mousteller, please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Hello, good afternoon, and thank you all for taking testimony. My name is Mark Mousteller. I'm in Palmer. And while I currently sit on the Matanuska Electric Association board, and I do a little bit of work with the UAF, Alaska Center for Energy and Power, I want to be really clear, I'm speaking only for myself. You know, I've spent the last 25 years working in the building science and energy efficiency and renewable energy sectors in Alaska, including 10 years as faculty in the UA Sustainable Energy Programs. And I'm here to support HB 153. I think this legislation will help us, number one, conserve Cook Inlet gas resources for things like home heating and power generation when renewables are not available, and regulation of variable power from wind and solar. It'll also improve integrated resource planning as the Rail Belt Reliability Council gets going. It'll help us stabilize our rates by encouraging development of projects that don't have recurring fuel costs, including things like hydro and hopefully geothermal and tidal. I'd love to see it. We need that baseload firm power. It'll also generally encourage Rail Belt utilities to continue working together to benefit all ratepayers. And, of course, rates in the Rail Belt affect our PCE rates. Finally, we know from many other jurisdictions across the country and globe that when you get some RPS legislation, they typically meet those goals early, and then they keep moving on from there. So thanks a lot for your consideration. I hope you'll vote to support HB 153.
Thank you very much. Next up, we've got Ben May, who had presented in front of the committee a few weeks ago. Please put yourself on the record, where you're from and your affiliation.
Thank you. For the record, this is Ben May from Anchorage, Alaska. I'm a 34-year resident of Alaska, and I'm the CEO and founder of Alaska Solar. For my very short 2 minutes, I'd like to focus on the double credit for residential and commercial energy generation that is part of this bill. This is something that I can speak to well. This is a jobs bill. Essentially, residential and commercial solar or other renewables in Alaska is built by Alaskans, so young people stay in Alaska and the money stays in Alaska. You cannot build solar remotely. You can't do it on a two-on, two-off schedule while living outside of Alaska. Also, I want to mention that there's great synergy between this bill and the separate annual net metering bill that is making its way through the legislature. The process of annual net metering makes solar much more profitable to the customer. If that takes off, then you will have more and more natural gas kept in the ground. We'll be able to heat with that natural gas, and we'll be able to address the upcoming crisis and raised rates. I also want to set the record straight on a few things. We produce power at about 12 to 14 kilowatt hours, or 12 to 14 cents per kilowatt hour. And this is versus the utility of 20 to 25 cents per kilowatt hour and soon to be around 30 cents per kilowatt hour. So it is cheaper, it is easier, and it is reliable. With 10 years of history and over 700 customers, all of our systems are operational, all of them. It takes very little maintenance, and there's very little trouble. Solar panels are very simple. It's a laminated glass. They just keep working. There's no moving parts. So this is energy made in Alaska. It's cheaper energy, especially when you include the capital costs of natural gas or other fossil fuel generation facilities. And we need a diversified solutions. We need a shotgun of solutions, not a single bullet. We need multiple sources to hedge prices and create reliability for Alaskans. So I support House Bill 153. I thank you for your time. I encourage you to also support it.
Thank you, Ben. Next up, we've got Amanda Garvey.
Hi, my name is Amanda Garvey. I'm from Palmer, and I'm representing my business, Sunstone Electric. I'm not representing any weird outside interests. I'm just a local Alaskan small business, and I'll end up paying the same rates as everybody. We're an Alaska Native-owned electrical contracting firm, and our staff has worked in over 200 communities throughout the state on a portfolio of commercial, residential, and industrial work, including on, you know, conventional power generation. But we have been also contractors on several of the utility-sized solar and battery projects throughout Alaska. I myself have a background in mechanical engineering, water and wastewater facilities, and I am an energy auditor. I think there's been a couple of things mentioned here that I don't know if people quite understand the flexibility in HB 153, and I'm calling in to support it, because it doesn't mandate utilities to specifically invest in solar or wind. It does allow flexibility in how you're meeting these portfolio standards, whether that's energy efficiency projects, net metering programs, you know, purchasing from an IPP, purchasing credits. There's a very wide flexibility in how this is applied. And we can talk about kind of the dates and the cost of the penalty, but this bill is actually really flexible about how we're going to meet the standard, and that the utilities will have to meet a standard of affordability. And I wanted to talk a little bit. I know a lot of people talked about the some of the failures of renewable projects across the country and the globe, but you know, Texas is now the leading adopter of solar, battery, and wind technology in the United States. They started their RPS in 1999, and they easily exceeded it quickly. And the Federal Reserve of Dallas has reported that solar and battery has greatly stabilized the grid, particularly during summer peaking loads, and that it'll help to buffer capacity to attract data centers and cryptocurrency mining in the future. A lot of these assets intend to install renewable sources behind the meter as well. Globally, I mean, we've talked a little bit about Germany, and everybody keeps bringing up Germany, but I'm part of the Cross-Arctic Exchange Program at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, looking at how these infrastructure projects have gone in, and I think we've missed a lot of the successful projects, like Iceland's geothermal project, which is now solvent, and they can take on large capital expenditure projects without requiring non-repayable public funding, and they have 40-mile-long district heating systems. The low and stable cost of electricity there and heating has spurred development of several international industries, including aluminum smelting and other industrial manufacturing, and they have a population about half of Alaska's. So, you know, what does this mean for a place, like what does renewable investment mean for a place like Alaska? It means places like Unalaska can attract customer bases like Trident and provide geothermal energy at a lower cost than imported fuel.
Please wrap up your testimony.
Yeah, Homer Electric Association produces hydro power at 4 cents per kilowatt hour, but its rates are higher because it has to rely on natural gas. So I think well-designed renewable projects in Alaska have shown to be extremely reliable.
Ms. Garvey, please wrap up.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, is she a yes or no?
Yes. Yeah, Ms. Garvey was in favor of the bill.
And thank
you very much. Next up, we've got Todd Lindley.
Good afternoon, members of the House Energy Committee. My name is Todd Lindley. I'm from Anchorage, representing myself. Thank you for the opportunity to share feedback today. I'm opposed to House Bill 153 and urge you to vote no. You speak of this as if the utility boards are committed to being in a renewable future. I don't believe that that is representative of the co-op membership. It's quite a coincidence that every utility board adopted decarbonization goals and supports an RPS to be less reliable and more expensive against their fiduciary duty. The sectional analysis appears to be a way to legalize environmental racketeering off the backs of every rail belt ratepayer. To say that renewables are cheaper than traditional energy generation is incompetence and negligence with the intent to defraud the public and extort the utilities. This bill needs to be removed from the ledger because it will do more harm and additional economic hardship throughout the state. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Ken Griffin, please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Yeah, this is Ken Griffin. I represent myself. I'm in Wasilla. I'm a business owner. I work in a business. I volunteer in my community. I donate money. I'm a taxpayer. Okay, what I'm telling you now is that the government has no sovereign right, no constitutional powers to mandate how a private business makes its power, nor where the consumer buys it from. This is not about climate change. It never has been. One gentleman on here said that wind and power, or wind and solar, are reliable, and then in the very same sentence said, they're very intermittent. I know what wind and solar are capable of because I've installed them from New York to Alaska, and I have 5 kilowatts of solar in my house. I know exactly what it's capable of, and it's completely unreliable. It's ridiculous to think that the state feels like it has the power to tell citizens to take a substandard of way of life or choice of power at a higher cost simply because they're the government and they could do so.
They call that raison d'etat, the idea that the state has the might, so the state has the right. Well, you don't. You don't have that right. And for you to be involved in this market is a bit ridiculous and quite offensive, to be honest with you, because it's not reliable. You simply don't have any business. Where did we get to secure and maintain our rights? How do we extract? I can tell private companies how to produce and where investors can buy. If this was a viable solution, people would be doing it on their own capital. There's only really two rules of economics when it comes to this. That is, that capital flows towards profit or capital flows towards government mandates. Because when the government can threaten businesses and people, people know that the money will come out of it. And that's what this bill does. Frankly, it's the cleanest version of socialism and redistribution that I've seen yet. But this is the Alaska way because you're geared towards things that produce subsidies. Electrical power generated by renewable resources is not affordable. And if you consider two things, the subsidies, the gargantuan amount of subsidies that the government should be doing, you have no mandate to take taxpayer money and play market maker. And two, the cost of replacement in 20 years when those panels and batteries wear out. We are already having a mineral problem producing what we have, let alone the replacement cost, the landfill cost, the reclamation cost. I know because I'm watching the same committees, finance and energy committees, that you are sitting in. So I know exactly what they're capable of, and I've taken the time to read the thousands of white papers written on the subject that say exactly what I'm telling you now that it seems most people who are testifying here are ignoring. It's inconvenient for you guys to come in here, for people to testify and act like this is some sort of problem-solving end-all, be-all. We have a mandate, produce power cheap and affordable. Also, what I don't see in this bill, and I'll wrap up my testimony here, is who's going to take on the reliability when we have rolling blackouts and we need it most in the summer, the winter when it's negative 30, when homes freeze and people die. I don't see the liability. Who's going to take the liability on when these people die? Or is that just going to be state sovereignty and we're good with that? I don't think so. I think this is a joke. It's offensive. And people need to take a second look at what you think sovereignty really means. You have no power. You represent it. And that's the fact. Thank you for your testimony.
Next up, we've got Penny Gage.
Hello. Good afternoon, Chair Mears and members of the committee. My name is Penny Gage, and I'm the Chief Policy and Partnerships Officer at Launch Alaska. We're a nonprofit organization based in Anchorage, and we work to accelerate technology deployment across the state in energy, transportation, and industrial systems. I started my career working in oil and gas, and what attracted me to this sector is how important it is to all of our lives. And I'm here to voice our organization's strong support for House Bill 153. We believe that this bill represents a smart, forward-looking policy that can drive job creation, attract private investment, and help lower long-term energy costs for Alaskans. Launch Alaska has a portfolio of 41 companies who all have active projects in Alaska or who are pursuing deployments. And since our founding, our companies have created 77 new jobs across 90 projects in our state. Since 2020, Launch Alaska has supported the deployment of $754 million in climate tech projects across the state. So we work every day with startups and industry partners like utilities, like traditional industries, like rural communities and urban communities who are ready to deploy clean energy technologies. But what they need, what we all need, is market certainty. An RPS sets a clear, achievable target which gives utilities, entrepreneurs, and investors the confidence to plan, invest, and innovate. We know the cost of renewables and storage are beginning to fall, while the cost of natural gas is only rising. And this is a chance for Alaska to lead in energy independence and innovation, not just to react to economic pressure, but shape our own energy future. This policy aligns with Launch Alaska's mission to strengthen our energy, transportation, and industrial sectors through innovation. And we urge you to pass an RPS and unlock economic opportunities that benefit all Alaskans. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next up, we have Aurora Roth.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, you're a little muffled.
Sorry, there's some ambient noise. Is that better?
Yes. Please go ahead. Put your name on the record.
My name is Aurora Ross, and I am making my comments for myself. I reside in Anchorage and Griffin Fairbanks. I'm in full support of House Bill 153. Although other utilities are 80% dependent on natural gas, and utility prices are subject to volatile global markets, even when gas is coming from the inlet, and the price has increased nearly 800% in my lifetime of 32 years. Renewable energy resources, on the other hand, can be locally owned and the prices are stable. While it's true that the initial capital costs must be paid for, once they are paid off, the prices are stable and do not include any fuel costs. This results in long-term affordability that makes you totally dependent on natural gas any way you slice it. The staff of the utilities have been working hard to determine the best integration for renewables and battery systems that can create reliable and affordable energy. I have been following this closely. However, an RPS would provide the structure and deadline for seeing these projects through. An RPS would also help attract more independent power producers to invest in projects and create competition, which will ultimately benefit consumers. Without an RPS, I fear more of the same: rising natural gas costs, rising bills, and a lack of imagination to utilize technology that works all across the globe, including in other cold climates, and we need to utilize this technology to benefit Alaskans. I also want to make the point of the government being involved in our energy system. We already subsidized the oil and gas industry, which the renewable energy markets have had to fight against. We have tax credits to the oil and gas industry. There are so many ways that that's baked into government already, and so this is not an exception for renewable energy to have policy like this with our state government. Thank you very much for your time. Please support HB 153, and thank you for all your hard work.
Thank you very much. Next up, I'd like to go to Ed Marshall.
Hello, my name is Ed Marshall. I'm in District 6, outside Slobodna. I am all for free choice and free market. And we are a republic, and we can govern as close to our houses as we can. In this case, it would be our local utilities. Our utilities all require votes. We all vote for board members. We all vote for board members who choose the direction we want to go. I am all for lobbyists who want to go to utilities and convince them that this is the path forward. And that is fine. If you can lay out an idea and sell to me that this is going to be cheaper, the individual utilities, to gas, Homer Electric, all of them, should be able to make the decision for themselves that they want to move in that direction. And if this solar, hydro, everything is as good as advertised, it should not take very long to convince people to do so. The fact that you want legislation to force this, because your tax is your teeth, right? And you say it's not a tax. We're changing the word. We're going, okay, it's not a tax. It's a fine. We're going to put it to a fund to pay later. What it is basically you cover for the utilities so they can later go buy the renewables from the lobbyists who have called in today advertising how great it is and that they want the state to advertise for them. And that's where we're at here, right? So if the state wants to get into the energy game, okay, let's stop playing with our oil and gas industry. Let's actually help develop that industry and get the prices down and energy cheap. And as Mr. Holland said, these rates are falling so fast. The cost of this is developing, and it's become so much cheaper. Well, if that's the case, let the utilities who are voted for by the users make that decision. I believe we should be set up for a lawsuit for this to be unconstitutional, for the state to come in and dictate the actual use of utility energy. That is a direct violation of our rights. I don't vote for this state. I did not see the state anywhere on my ballot for HEA board member. So if Mr. Holland would like to develop a bill to come in and get on HEA, or the fellow with the wind farm, or the guy with the hydroelectric, or the gentleman with the solar in Anchorage, if they would like to actually develop a bill and come and put it on my HEA ballot, I'd be more than happy to consider it if they can give me the facts and show me that it's going to be cost effective. In the meantime,
I don't believe this is any of the state's business or right. And I do believe Mrs. Andrews right when she says you are setting yourself up for a lawsuit. And well, I don't know if you guys can count pennies very well, but you've already done writing us up a debt this, and so I don't think you need to be cashing out future lawsuits.
Please wrap up your testimony.
Yeah, I think I've got my point across. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Next up, we've got Patrice Lee.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. In Fairbanks, all of our generation is old, dirty, end of life. May I say that while I am the coordinator of Citizens for Clean Air, a grassroots, local, unfunded, never had any money from anybody group who advocates for clean air and warm homes, it remains that our generation facilities are old, end of life, unreliable. And I would like to associate myself with the comments of Mike Kraft, Chris Rose, and Santa Claus. I think a lot of people are confused between the ability for renewables to offset energy and baseload power. Nobody is saying that solar and wind are going to become the baseload power. What they are saying is that those renewable sources are available to offset our subsistence generation. Hawaii paid attention to the 2010 discussion going on with Senator Palin, and they set a goal for 50% of their power to be renewable by 2025. And they have met that goal, and they're doing beautifully, wonderfully. Now, we have wind in the winter and solar in the summer, and those things are proven everywhere. I find it kind of disconcerting that people discount those, because in Fairbanks, we're down to rolling brownouts, blackouts. We don't have enough power generation to have a reliable source. So we need something to offset that, and the renewable portfolio does set some standards that can be relied upon for businesses and others to try to set for a goal. If you don't set a benchmark or a goal, you know, you're not going to hit that. It's also disconcerting for me to hear someone say this topic has been around for a long, long time. It isn't something that Representative Holland or somebody just brought up. He just happens to be putting the bill forward. The issue has been going on for 15 or 20 years. And in Fairbanks, if we don't do something different, we're going to be in a world of hurt. And we're the coldest place, you know, 40, 50 below it can be. So, I would like to say that the health problems involved in burning fossil fuels are terrible. The economic analysis has never been properly done. It has never included the cost of going to the doctor or getting an inhaler or trying to find health care in an underserved area. Clean coal, what is that? We have coal ash all over this town where our water supplies have been impacted and our wetlands, our wildlife, it's endless. So if we're not going to move forward and take advantage of offsetting our power generation with renewables, then what is it we're going to do? And thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And then finally, telephonically for testimony, we have Ben Bedger.
Hello, I'm Ben Becker, calling in from Soldotna, strongly supporting the bill. The issues we're experiencing with natural gas, as it becomes more expensive and less reliable, should have taken no one by surprise. Previous caller, Chris Rose, spoke very well about the history of studies and forecasts and the inadequate utility response. The utilities on their own have not taken timely, proactive, or effective steps to diversify power and control costs. And it's well within the legislature's role and responsibility to incentivize utilities to take actions that benefit their repairs. Even if you assume that utilities will move toward renewables for gas conservation, even without a legislated standard, the RPS still encourages better outcomes by requiring the utilities to coordinate their renewable investment and planning through the integrated resource plan, and even provide incentives for shared wind resources. Which the National Renewable Energy Laboratory identified as an important part of an economically optimal rail belt grid. as renewable energy is capital intensive and it benefits greatly from economies of scale. So having clear and definite milestones is a benefit for utilities, developers, investors, and ratepayers. And there's a well-documented history of cost to consumers that result when railroad utilities have failed to coordinate their investments. So the RPS is important, even if the market is going to move toward renewables, it's still beneficial to set these standards for better planning that help contain costs for consumers. So thank you for considering the bill, and I hope that you'll support it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Becker. So that concludes the folks we've got online. Just verifying one more time that nobody in the room is looking to testify today. All righty. So I will hold open public testimony, but we will close it for today. Have a question?
I have a couple of questions. And Madam Chair, thank you. One is, will we be able to hear from the utilities before this moves out of committee?
Representative Holland.
Great. Thanks for the chair. I want to ask staff if you could respond to that. I don't know where you feel like we're at with utilities. I know we're being very purposeful of working with them at this point, and I know they're under different deliberations in their organizations thinking about this. So we're trying to give them time and space. We're also trying to listen to them and take their feedback as we move along this process. So if you could add any more to that, I think that's as much as I can offer at the moment, but maybe you've got a little more you feel like you can share.
Through the chair, Shana Kilcoyne, for the record. That's correct. We are working closely with them, and this is not the end of the process. It's not our intent to leave them out.
Oh, Ed, can I follow up?
Follow up.
Great. Thank you, through the chair. The other thing I just want to remind everybody in this process is that this is not the only committee either, so I don't know how far we'll get in this committee before we, you know, get it moved on to what was originally the first committee referral. This got inserted into the process. And so, you know, whether or not the utilities, because of the timing of their meetings and their decision-making authority, whether or not they have their meetings and feel like they have the authorization to speak on this at, in the same timing that we're going to move this along, I can't predict. But I can say also that, you know, that this will potentially move on to the next committee before all of the timing of those utilities have played out in their process. So I just want to also recognize that we don't think this will be the be-all, end-all in this committee in our process, that the next committee will be another opportunity to continue the dialogue if the timing is helpful to others that may want to participate at a time that matches their availability.
And one follow-up question?
Follow-up.
I think I put them in my folder. I think it was this guy... Ken Griffin, and if it wasn't, I apologize. He was talking about the constitutionality of this, the fines that are being levied. So I was wondering, if we pass language that's later found to be unconstitutional, and it does take a while to go through courts, nothing goes in a week or two. So say this happens for a couple of years, we finally get through the courts, and then we find out that it's unconstitutional. What would happen to the money that they've already had to be fined?
To the chair?
Go ahead.
Well, I think first off, you know, the underlying work that's being done here has been many years of work here in the legislature to develop a framework for the RPS. The RPS has been developed over many years across the country. And I think successfully, and as you heard from a few of our testifiers, with folks putting in place RPSs, meeting those goals, and then deciding to continue beyond those goals. So I think there's a pretty solid framework for what we're doing here. Now, if somebody found that our Constitution uniquely provided some reason to challenge us, you know, I think the other thing to consider is that the first threshold for meeting a level of compliance is out in 2032. So if this took a couple of years because somebody chose to try and explore, you know, whether or not the Alaska Constitution provided some sort of unique framework, I think we've got a little bit of time to do that.
And I would agree with you. I can say that in my past experience running with this, we're talking about co-ops in the state. And very few other states are talking about co-ops when we talk about RPSs.
Mm-hmm. Shana, question. Because we have had a couple. I'm sorry. To the chair, the question that Representative Rauscher asked might have some more information, because we have been getting some legislative legal memos along the way here, and I don't know whether there's anything more in those legislative memos that speaks to Representative Rauscher's question.
Just let me speak to this. So for those watching, we have a legislative legal department that advises us here. If we draft bills or amendments that they feel may cause legal issues or constitutional issues, that they bring that up in the process. So we do have some checks and balances here. That's not to say that folks from time to time don't run things that has been flagged, but we do have that process here and do check in with that as we go through our legislative process.
So if I can follow up.
Follow up.
Shana, have we received any memos in the process of working on the original bill or the CS that flagged any sort of constitutional issue at this point in time?
Through the chair, Shana Kilcoyne, for the record, we have not received any legal memos or concern about this being a constitutional concern.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. So I do want to note that we are planning on further public testimony. Our next meeting is scheduled for Tuesday, April 15th at 1 p.m. But I'd also like to note that our legislative schedule right now is always in flux and subject to change. So I highly recommend folks provide written testimony, and the email for that, again, is house.energy@akleg.gov. So we're guaranteed to get it. It will be on the public record, and we want to hear from you. So today, I'm not setting an amendment deadline. As we continue to get public input and work with stakeholders and committee members, we will email members with an amendment deadline. The committee will now set the bill aside for further consideration. Our next scheduled meeting, as I just mentioned, of the House Energy Committee is next Tuesday, April 15th. The agenda we will be emailed out to members when available. So with no further business before the committee, this meeting is adjourned at 2:46 p.m.